Collaborist. I'm Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buchholz.
And you are listening to Collaboracast. How's it going, Jay?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to talk to my friend and colleague, John Ritter, today. He is the author of the crime novel Fatal Conceit, among other things. This one came out a couple years ago, so we're going to be chatting with him about the genre.
All right. And I just want to do a quick plug here for anyone who's interested. I will be running a writer's group this summer from June through August, meeting twice a month. I'm looking for people who are in the early stages of working on a novel right now. This is not going to be about reading long passages from each other's books, but it's going to be more about giving writers an opportunity to walk through the process of plot, pacing, character motivation, et cetera, in a small group setting. Got room for about 4 to 6 people, and I will be joined in all of this by this summer intern, Maddie, who will be just being very much a big part of all of this. So thank you to Maddie. If you're interested in joining this writing group, please send an email to ben@collaborist.org, and I can answer any questions or sign you up. So, without any further ado, Jay, are we ready to bring John Ritter on?
Let's do it.
Good to see you, John.
Nice to meet you and see you guys too, yeah.
Welcome, John. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, yeah.
Those of you listening, John Ritter is from small town Midwest roots. He bounced around America growing up, Kentucky, Texas, Wyoming, Southern California. He earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Kansas, which was interrupted by 2 years of hitchhiking in the Southwest and work as a carpenter's helper and meat cutter. He began a reporting career at 2 upstate New York newspapers the summer Nixon resigned. Then came a short stint in Phoenix at the Arizona Republic before hiring on at this little startup called USA Today in Washington. He spent 28 years there as an editor on the national desk, then as a general assignment reporter, handling both breaking news and in-depth stories about the environment, education, aviation, and politics. He and a colleague were named 1995 Pulitzer Prize finalists in investigative reporting. A move to the Bay Area as a national correspondent found Ritter on the road up and down the West Coast and throughout the Mountain West. He left journalism in 2009 to write fiction and currently splits time between Northern California and Southeast Asia. Fatal Conceit is his first published manuscript. So Fatal Conceit, which I had the great pleasure of assisting John with. John is one of my... had the pleasure of working with John over what? Probably the last 15 years, 10. Maybe? 10 yeah. Plus...
It's all kind at of... least 10, at least 10, but you know, yeah. Who's counting, right?
Yeah, at this point, it's better not to count.
That's right.
So I've had the, I've been in the fortunate position to have been able to read a number of John's works. This one, I'm going to use we just because I need all
sure,
the all
no, credit absolutely. I can possibly no, get. Absolutely. Yeah, no.
We managed to get out and into the world. This features your character, Beaupré. A private investigator who joins an eminent list bursting with humor, pugnacity, and a leaky moral code bent on one-upping San Francisco's finest while wooing a prosecutor-turned-lover. A talented investigator, Beaupré muddles through his own hubris and missteps, leaving a trail of bodies and recrimination. Booted from the police force for knocking a skinhead comatose and allegedly battering a girlfriend, he radiates confidence spiked with arrogance for which innocents pay dearly. Hired to find the killer in a moldy double murder, he sniffs out a drug trail, misreads a string of homicides, and not until he and a computer hacker sidekick track down a fugitive in Asia does the scope of a vast criminal drug and money laundering conspiracy reveal itself. So, John, I guess my first question for you would be, so this is... I think Beaupré has all of the kind of the classic bravado and sarcasm and wit of, you know, kind of some of the greats of that genre, which is classic and has been, you know, we've had people writing private PI detective police stories for decades now. And so how did you come into this genre? So obviously it's so prone to cliches and moldy tropes. How do you go into something like this, knowing that you have to really bring something new and unique to it? And so what was it like for you to go into this, knowing that there are a lot of great writers, a lot of traps? How did you avoid falling into those?
Well, I had some models, some great models, you know, obviously Robert B. Parker and some of the detective writers from the past, Elmore Leonard, who I'm not in his class, but he's somebody that you can, you know, aspire to and learn from. Anyway, I just thought that I wanted to do this. I was coming off a manuscript that was in the third person, multiple POV, and you know, it wasn't working out. I wasn't able to sell it. So I just said, let's just try something new, first person with this, you know. But to answer your question more specifically, I decided that number one, there had to be some humor. He had to be unconventional to a degree, and he had to have his own burdens. Now that's not unusual for this genre, but if the burdens are unique, you know, it comes across. So, you know, I just, based on that, I had an idea, obviously, a kernel of an idea, and I started plotting it out. And as with most of my writing anyway, a lot of it gets developed and created along the way, including characters. So, you know, that's what happened. And over the course of time, it fortunately came together.
So you took the approach of really, you talk about it. Can you say a little more about his burdens? That's an interesting angle for me. So this was kind of the baggage that he carries.
Well, his mother was a classic, she wasn't classic. She had a mental illness and was hospitalized, and his dad, who he's very close to, died. He was very close to him. He's an only child. And, you know, I guess the burdens are more that he encountered in his career. You know, he was a bit of a hothead, and he went off on this skinhead, and he had an altercation that got blown out of proportion with a girlfriend, and he lost his job on the police force. And so he's carrying this baggage around, which, as the novel gets deeper, you find out some of this baggage is actually connected to the case that he's working on. And that makes it more interesting in my view. I don't know. Does that answer your question, Jason?
Yeah, it does. I have my own ideas about what makes him a unique character, but I wanted to hear what you wanted to hear your response before I jumped in.
Well, you know, I'm just way too close to it. I'd be highly interested in hearing what you think. Yeah.
Well, I think for me personally, what makes Beaupré stand out is his voice, or your voice kind of working through him there. But there is a level of intelligence and cultural literacy to your work, to your writing, and to Beaupré's narration that I find it there's a reading pleasure that comes along with these, and I say these because I've had the pleasure of reading the follow-up to this, as I hope many other people soon will have the opportunity to.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. I appreciate it. Yeah,
but the references, and so here, this is a list of references that I pulled from a page and a half, 1.5 pages of Fatal Conceit, where Beaupré refers to Bear Grylls, Pike's Peak, Mount Rushmore, the Galapagos, the Bronx, a Sole Gourmet Grill, the book, the first edition of You Know Me, Al by Ring Lardner, Sam Spade, Bartlett's Quotations, Zen Buddhism, a Boeing 747, and the Peloponnesian War.
God, now, come on. How did you pull that out of here?
I was looking through it this morning, and this is one of the things I want to talk about. And I was talking to Ben before we jumped on today. So I do the New York Times crossword as far as I can every week. I'm pretty good Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday, I kind of start. Thursday's the hill that I die on mostly.
Okay.
So reading your work is it like getting all these references. You read through the list of clues and it's erudite. It's, you know, there are connections to all kinds of things in culture, in history, other books, other genres, and Beaupré is constantly making reference to all of these things. And I'd say that I get what he's talking about 75% of the time. A little bit like kind of that Wednesday, Thursday New York Times crossword attempts for me, where I feel really accomplished. So I really appreciate that. So Ben and I work with a lot of new writers, a lot of writers who are just starting out, just learning the craft. One of the things that we are constantly trying to impart to our clients, to the authors we work with, is to don't underestimate the reader. I think that there is a tendency among beginning writers to over-explain things, to assume that the reader has to have their hand held at every step of the way and walk through everything. So we're constantly saying, no, treat your reader as if they are, you know, just talk to them like they're really smart. And if they don't get everything, that's fine. And I feel like you are just you're really a master of that. I just wondered what your approach was and what advice you might share with a beginning author whose tendency might be to dumb things down a little too much.
Well, I'm a self-taught fiction writer, you know, which is, I wouldn't recommend that route, but that's what I did. And one of the first things when you delve into the, how do you do this, is don't do what you just said. In other words, don't tell the reader everything that's going on. So I just tried to live by that religiously as I went through this, for one thing. And I think you just have to, you know, you just have to constantly step back and say, okay, you know, this is what I want out there. I don't want too much out there. And I think in the case of Fatal Conceit, I might've erred a little bit in that direction. I think I took some hits from, I don't even remember who, but that there was too much, you know, that was not understandable, or too much that was just too arcane or too, but the other thing is, I think when you use something historical or current or whatever, you can't belabor it. It has to be quick. It has to be in the stream you're writing in. You can't just say, you know, you can't say, stop, I'm going to explain the Grand Canyon. You know, I mean, and I think beginning writers probably, and I did to an extent too, you have to just, you know, it's just, you use it, but you move on. It's quick and you can't belabor it.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think that that's another thing that another dimension we should add to this conversation, because given that list of things that I just read through, and given the fact that they all appear in a page and a half, it would be easy to get the impression that it's just an endless series of cultural references. But all of those come up during a scene where, I don't remember the character's name, but he comes into Beaupré's office, tries to buy him off the case. When Beaupré refuses, he pulls out a gun. So this is a very fast-paced scene, and none of these references, not in the hands of a less skilled writer, they could be speed bumps for the reader, where you're like, I don't know what's going on here.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, you can't. Yeah, it has to be in the mood and the tension that's going on. You can't, you know, just stop and say, okay, let's throw this reference in. It's got to be, you know, natural, and I don't know how to exactly say it, but
it's all in service to the plot and the character and the characters. It's like you manage to include these references and these layers of references, these really intelligent references that provide their own reading pleasure, but it's all like, it never gets in the way. It's always in service of the more important factors, the plot development, character development. And when I don't get things, it's fine. It doesn't prevent me from understanding what's happening. When I get them, it just adds this extra dimension, but it's kind of this little bonus. It's kind of this quick little bonus that you get as you go along, because you still have all of the other, you know, the momentum and the pace and the danger and everything else that make this genre so fun to read.
Well, I like to see that in books I read too. And I might be, well, I don't think I am unique, but I think, you know, when I encounter stuff like that, I very often look it up. And obviously now with Google, it's pretty easy and quick. But you identified the key thing. It can't get in the way. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just, it's there in passing, and it adds to the flavor, but it doesn't get in the way of what you're trying to do in a scene.
Yeah. Well, that's an aspect that I really admire in your work. And I think that,
thank you.
As people are learning how to do this, you know, I think you provide a great example of how to do it well. And how to not get in your own way, how to not kind of let your own, not to let your own kind of attempts at uniqueness get in the way of doing the things, you know, the real work of telling the story and kind of some of the basic elements of storytelling craft.
John, when you were making the switch from doing journalism to writing fiction, did you run into any challenges that was sort of hard to let go of journalistic tendencies when creating fiction? The reason I ask is I've worked with a few either current journalists who want to explore fiction or former journalists writing fiction, and their brain is so trained in the ways of journalism that are not in accordance with how fiction is written. And I'm just wondering if you ran into that, and if you did, what steps you took to separate the two and be able to write fiction cleanly.
Well, that's a really good question, Ben. I think, you know, journalists that are trying to transition into fiction have an advantage in that they know their way around a sentence and a paragraph, and they know a little bit about structure. But I don't know. I think you just have to kind of have a, first you got to be able to, you know, think up a story, create a story. And I, you know, was very slow going in the beginning for me. And my early attempts, as Jason can tell you, were fairly crude, for lack of a better word. And, you know, the thing about fiction is, for me, I came out of journalism thinking, and I think maybe some of my colleagues would agree, I was a pretty good reporter and writer in it from a journalistic sense. But fiction's a whole new ballgame in terms of the actual writing, which is far more key than in journalism. And my writing 10, 15 years ago versus now is, you know, night and day. I'm a much better writer, and I got better through the process, by just doing it. And, you know, I tried to read more. I used to love nonfiction. Well, I switched and I read exclusively fiction for a long time, and tried to pay attention to it and made notes. And, and tried to figure out how, you know, this was being done. And it was a it was a process. If I'd have gone to a creative writing school in, you know, Iowa or wherever, the process for me probably would have been shorter. And you know, I was not at an age or a circumstances to do that. So it is what it is. I mean, but yeah, I don't know. I think every journalist Ben comes out of it differently, and it's all about if you got an idea, if you got a story, if you come up with characters, and if you can write dialogue, you just, I don't know, kind of plunge in. Does that answer you at all? Or
yeah, yeah. And a follow-up question to that is completely unrelated and not a follow-up at all. But I read, Jason read a bio, but I read a different bio that says, I think that you were born in Kansas. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
What part?
Eastern Kansas, small town about 100 miles southwest of Kansas City.
What? I ask because my kin comes from that area, southeastern Kansas. Scammon, Arma, Kansas, the coal mining of southeastern Kansas. So it sounds like you went southwest from Kansas, and I was going basically straight down Highway 69.
Well, I'm basically straight down Highway 75.
Okay.
So I've kind of heard of those areas, but it's a little different. I mean, I know Kansas gets blown off as pretty bland, but there are variations in the geography, and the one absolutely you just mentioned, I'm not that familiar with. I spent a couple years, I spent through second grade there, moved away. My old man was jumping around at various college jobs, came back, graduated from high school, immediately left, went to college, and really never beyond that had much of a tie, family, of course, but so I didn't spend a lot of time there really. But you know, it is, your roots are your roots. So what are you going to do? Right.
Yeah.
kind of continuing with to explore the connections to journalism. I'm wondering if there were skills or experiences that you had as a journalist that, you know, so Ben kind of asked if there was anything that got in the way. I'm kind of interested in the inverse of that. Were there things that you learned, skills, experiences that really helped you? So you're writing a private investigator. You were an investigative journalist. It's a process of investigation. I wonder how much of your journalism career comes into the way that you're plotting things and the way that you have Beaupré approaches cases.
That's a good question too, Jason. I would say some, but not as much as you might think. I mean, I think as a reporter, I was fortunate to be able to do a lot of different things and to be actually out in the Bay Area for a number of years as a kind of a roving correspondent. I got to see a lot of different situations and do a lot of really kind of cool things versus somebody who sits behind a terminal inside the Beltway and writes about politics his whole career. I think I had maybe a little broader background because of what I did. I'm not sure how much it helped me writing fiction, though, quite honestly. I mean, I think you have to, it's all about the story, you know, and you got to have a story that you want to write and that you feel works as a story, you know, and if you don't have that, you really, I don't know what to say. I don't know where you go.
You do need that. But another thing that I love about your work is how strong your settings are, how strong the sense of geography is in them. And so, you know, I'm reminded of that as you're talking about being a correspondent and being able to travel around the Bay Area in particular. And obviously that's a place that's very near and dear to my heart and in my own work. So, you know, that's just something for this local boy personally. But In Fatal Conceit, Beaupré goes to, you know, starts out in Bay Area. He goes to Mexico, goes to Thailand. He's up in kind of the Pomo country and far northern California, Mendocino County. In your more recent manuscript, you're Alaska, Montana. And I'm struck by there's a real interplay between story and location and setting. It isn't just like, oh, I just need to set this somewhere different where there's different scenery. It's the story is really woven into these places and into the exchanges between them and as Beaupré travels around following these clues. And so I was curious about your approach there and whether you kind of have these locations that suggest scenes or if you have story and then you're trying to figure out where to set that or kind of how does location and setting play into, how does that interact with your plotting?
Well, I think readers like interesting locales and I think they, they like it when you take them to Thailand for 8 or 10 scenes over there. He was chasing a guy. And I think they like that because it's like what we were saying about the references. You can't overdo it. It has to be seamless. And it has to be, like you said, part and parcel to the story you're trying to tell. You can't just go create go to the Rocky Mountains for some reason that has nothing to do with your story. But I think, I don't know. I mean, I like geography and locales and traveling. And I think, readers do too. Even if they don't do it themselves, they like to read about it. And if you can put your story or part of your story in an interesting place, I think it just adds,
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that. It never feels like tourism, it never feels like you're doing it just for
the key thing. That's right. That's the key thing. It has to be there for a specific, has to be integral to the story. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I think that there could be a temptation to, oh, I'm going to go, this scene is going to be at the Eiffel Tower. This is going to be on the Golden Gate Bridge, taking these really, well-known kind of postcard spots. But even as you're writing about the Bay Area, you've got scenes in El Cerrito and scenes on the salt flats that are out down outside San Jose and these areas that are off the beaten path, but very much reveal the character of a place.
That's right.
And of course you spend a lot of your time in Thailand. So, in particular, your scenes there are rich and very immersive, and you have that insider view of not you clearly didn't just Google Thailand and the most popular places in Thailand and that's where I'm going to go set my scenes. You're writing about that from an insider's perspective.
Well, I don't think that's another good point. I don't think you can go to Google and create your setting. I think you have to be there. Yeah, I've spent some over the years back and forth to Thailand, and I've been to Mendocino. My wife and I used to go up there for weekends. The salt ponds, I'd never been there. I thought it was cool, so I went down there and spent a day and just tromped around. I think you've got to know what that those locales, you can't just go, you can't just do a computer search and figure this out. It's because it just doesn't quite come off. I don't think, I mean, maybe you can, I think it's possible, but if you've been there, you just bring a little bit more to it, I think.
I agree. I mean, I think you can pull it off, but it's never going to have the same dimension or depth.
Yeah.
Than it would if you've been there, if you know the sights and sounds. It's like, yeah, you can find something, get it on your computer screen, but you're not going to be able to describe the quality of the silence or the smells or some of these subtleties.
Yeah, that's right.
maybe that's your background as a journalist coming into. It's like you got to do the legwork. You got to get there, get your boots on the ground.
Well, and the thing, journalism teaches you details matter, and you know you can't be overgeneralized. I mean, the details, the interesting part, the interest is in the details, you know, and what you. So if you're at a specific locale, if you're in Bangkok, you want to talk about, you know, weave in how it is to get around and eat and the people to an extent that, you know, without it getting in the way of what you're trying to, getting in the way of the story, getting in the way of the plot. But it's, you know, that's just, I think readers like that is the whole thing. And, you know, I think a lot of novels are well read because of their locales. You know, maybe it doesn't have to just be a bunch of locales. It can be a single place, but it's, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me in particular, I really appreciate that because in my own writing, I've heard similar feedback, and for me, it's just it's just important to be really grounded in a place. You know, we have some stories that just take place in a house or in a town or in a city. And I think that there's a level of specificity and immersion that you lose if you don't have it in a place where you really know and can really have your characters move around, use the full extent of what that stage offers. And I admire that about your work.
Well, and yeah, I mean, I don't know, your novel Paper Sun, for example, there was quite a little of that. In fact, it got to China. I don't know if you went to China, you just, based on your background, you know it well enough, but that was maybe one of the coolest part of your book, I thought, you know. And again, locale, it's an interesting locale, and it makes the reader perk up.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you mentioning that. And I did travel there. Our parents took us there. I was probably about a junior or senior in high school. So we spent a few weeks traveling around. Obviously, it's 1920s China. I haven't been to 1920s China. Right. So I did have to use some creative license. But the economy there, you know, it's there are a lot of places in the world currently where things haven't changed much. These agrarian, you know, rice paddies, and it isn't. There are some places where, okay, everyone has a cell phone now, but they're doing the same thing.
The basic culture is the same. That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
The basic culture. Yeah.
The yearly cycle, the way, you know, the seasons. It's farming and
the religion, the what they eat, all that doesn't change that much over time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And they've got cell phones now, but beyond that, it's, you know, a lot of the rhythms of daily life are the same. So zooming out a little bit, how are you doing with brainstorming names for the new manuscript? Any headway?
I'm still nowhere. thanks for asking.
you gotta keep you going, keep you moving along.
I think I told you when we had lunch the other day that for me, at least the last time around on the title, I was nowhere, and I just had to sit down with and, you know, go to thesaurus.com and just basically put your brain on it. It's not fun, but put your brain on it for as long as it takes. And, you know, I've just been lazy. I haven't done that, but I will soon. So to answer your question, no, I'm nowhere on a title yet.
So title, few finishing touches, and then agent search.
Yeah. And I was hoping I don't know how appropriate this is to your podcast, but my publisher is, for a lot of reasons, not going to be my publisher again. So I needed to find another one. And that, of course, means going the agent route. And I thought, well, when I sold this novel, oh, wow, I never have to do all those queries again. I can just, you know, but here I am and it is what it is. So, you know, no use complaining.
Yep. Part of the process. Yeah. Ben was my publisher and then he had to go and stop being a publisher. So
okay.
I gotta go recreate that as well. You had mentioned, I'm curious about, so you know, the new manuscript is another Beaupré title, and you had mentioned towards the end of that lunch that you were feeling the pull of getting away from that first person, one single protagonist narration. And you talk a little bit about how what your feelings are there and how that has felt constraining, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what's causing you to feel that shift?
Well, I don't know. I did feel like it's a little bit restrictive compared with, you know, a more wide open third person, but, and I don't have a great appetite for mounting another Beaupré investigation. Now, if a publisher said, well, you know, I want you to, and it might behoove you to do that, I'd probably change my mind. But I'd also had a manuscript that you're familiar with from years back that I, when I was really more of a beginning phase and didn't think it was particularly well written. And when I look at it today, but various people, including yourself, thought the story was good. So I thought, well, I'm going to go back to that. And that's, as I think the one that you're currently working on is multiple POV third person. And I don't know. In some ways, for me anyway, it feels more free and I can just, and there's more, there's more to draw on, more to get out there. I just think, I don't know. And it's a change of pace. So, you know, I don't want to say I was tired of doing first person, but I was ready to try something different, at least for now.
Yeah. I would love to see you tackle that with, you know, get, like you said, you've evolved tremendously as a writer over the last decade and taking, you know, kind of the sensibilities that you've developed and going back to those stories, I think would be really fascinating. It is multiple third person is a kind of a much broader palette, but it brings with it a lot of its own challenges. So it's a different set of decisions. There's like a whole set of decisions that you have to make, which characters and when you're going to switch and how. That you know, you don't have to grapple with if you're doing just a first person single narrator throughout.
I think you're right. I think also though that to an extent the story dictates that. Although I may be glossing over the struggles I went through back in the day when I was putting this manuscript together. Now it seems because I started working through it a little bit, and it. Now it seems natural and like, you know, natural break to go to this voice versus that voice. And, but you're right. I mean, I think it's just a different ball game to an extent. I just think, you know, when you're writing from first person, you just, I felt it was a little limiting for me personally. I'm happy to move on from that for now, at least.
Well, I think you've done a fantastic job of Beaupré, and I really hope that the new manuscript gets representation and gets a deal.
Yeah.
I would love to see, I would read as many of these as you are willing to write. So while part of me wants you to go and spread your wings and explore, another part of me wants a publisher to come to you and say, hey man, Give me five of these. Here's a check.
Yeah. Well,
I would love to have more Beaupré stories to look forward to.
I told you over lunch that I actually had two kernels of an idea. And by kernels of an idea, I mean like the two sentence. Okay, this is what we can base a book around. Beaupré related. And but I don't want to, you know, like you say, if somebody makes it worth my while, of course I'd probably consider doing that. But you know, for now I'm gonna try moving on a little bit.
Fair enough. Right on. Well, Ben, anything else you want to ask of John before we let him get back to his day?
No, thank you for stopping by Collaboracast, John.
Well, thank you for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Do you have a social media account, website, anything that you want to direct people to?
You can go to John Ritter Fiction. .com, and that's got a lot about Fatal Conceit and about my background. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, so you can find me there. I stayed away from TikTok so far, but
So yeah, you can learn about Fatal Conceit at johnritterfiction.com. Do you have a preferred local indie bookstore that people should order from that you want to give a shout out to?
I don't even think any bookstores still have mine on the shelf. I mean, I think you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it on Barnes & Noble, and you can get it from the publisher, which is touchpointpress.com. You can order there. I don't think you're going to find it in a bookstore, frankly, as long as it's been. I didn't have much, you know, this novel came out in the middle of the pandemic, and I think that was good for some writers and not so good for others. And I don't think it was particularly good for me. I didn't get the book placed too many places despite a lot of effort. So.
Well, it's out there. It's available.
Yeah.
You can find it. Thanks for joining us. Hope to have much more of your work to look forward to in the future, John.
Great, Jason. Ben, both of you, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.